Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, the BBC have sacked disabled presenter David Lowe, who does Swingers and Singers every Sunday. And Annie Walker joins us to talk about the Bush Respite Centre in Hengrove. She's campaigning to keep all the beds open. Plus, Jason Yannakopoulos will be looking through the news and talking about the Rosicrucians again. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk, and I'll repeat their contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Annie Walker. Annie, hi and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
Whereabouts in Bristol are you from?
I live in Brislington.
And you have a son, I understand, at this Bush Respite Centre in Hengrove. At least he's there sometimes. Just tell us about your son and why he goes there from time to time.
My son is 14 years old. He was diagnosed with cerebral palsy from birth, and we've been using the centre approximately once every fortnight since around about January. We had some other issues taking place. We had a sudden death in the family and things happening which put extra pressure on us as a family, so we were able to access the centre. And we really appreciate the facility that's there.
Just tell us a bit about cerebral palsy. How has it affected your son?
He was born without much hope at all. He was not able to see until he was 9 months old. He was suffering with seizures at night time, which had a huge impact on our family life. He's made phenomenal progress from when he was born, but he's still really hard work. I have to get up at night and care for him, and he's an amazing character fellow. He's got a great sense of humour. He's just a super little kid, but he's only one in the bigger puzzle or the bigger picture of the whole family and issues with grandparents and other family members. And as a carer, I began to find it quite difficult since Christmas to keep on top of everything, and I really hugely value the opportunity to just go and have a good night's sleep.
Okay, so that's the main reason he goes to respite care. Tell us a little bit about the centre, because I understand it's in Hengrove and it's just been refurbished.
It was recently refurbished in order to comply with Ofsted, and it comprises of two separate wings. So one wing is for the younger children and one wing for the teenagers. And one of the good things about the centre is that it actually meets a kind of social need of these children who have so little opportunity to socialise. When you think of a normal child, in inverted commas, when they come home from school, they do their homework and then they go out and play and do stuff with other children. Whereas for special needs children, it's often the case they come home, they're in front of the TV until they go back to school, you know, bedtime, and then back to school next morning. So it gives them a unique opportunity to have social interaction with other, a small group of other children. It's brilliant.
Does Liam get much in the way of an education, anything like a normal child would do, if we can use that word, a non-disabled child at age 14?
Well, he attends Claremont School at Redland Green, which is a fantastic school for cerebral palsy children. I would just like to say thank you to George Ferguson, the mayor, because this week he was at Redland Green School promoting the Starfish Pool appeal. The Starfish Pool appeal needs an extra £250,000 to reach their goal, and they're planning to build a hydrotherapy pool which will benefit all the special needs children across Bristol, particularly the teenagers. And we're just on the last leg of the appeal. Thank you very much to the mayor. Well done. Great work. But I do have other issues to take up with you.
Okay, well, I mean, most people do, don't they, with the mayor. But just tell us a little bit about the Bush Respite Centre. What is it, you know, what kind of facilities does it provide there? Do you simply just take Liam and they look after him for how many days? I mean, what facilities have they got?
You take the child would go there either straight from school or on a weekend, it would be from 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They have they have games, they have activities, they do trips, they do a lot of interactive stuff with the children that's especially aimed at them. to meet their needs. And then each child has their own room with their own bed. So they would have, they've got a jacuzzi bath that the children love.
Oh, I bet they do.
And they would have a bath, they'd be put to bed. They love it. In fact, my son recently arrived outside of the centre and he was clapping his hands with joy and he just said, "Mum, I love it, I love it, I'll never get sick of it." And he just, it's brilliant.
Now, there's a consultation going on at the moment, isn't there? Because there are thoughts about getting rid of some of the beds there. Now, for a start, that's a bit surprising since all the money's just been spent. But what's this consultation looking at?
Well, Bristol City Council are conducting a consultation process until the 30th of June, and they've already produced a draft commissioning plan, and it's looking at short breaks and other services for disabled children and their families. Well, short breaks are activities and services to give disabled children and young people a break from their parent carer, for parents and carers to have a break also from caring from their child. Well, that covers a wide spectrum of areas. It could be foster-based short breaks, residential holidays, community care and palliative care, residential overnight short breaks and other targeted services. But the spotlight is now being shone particularly on the Bush Centre.
Okay, palliative care, what's that?
For children that are terminally ill.
Oh, okay. Now, the whole point of this place seems to be to really relieve parents who are having a lot of stress and difficulty caring for disabled children. Any idea how many parents there are out there that are still in need, are actually not getting the help with respite care?
Well, the Bristol City Council has identified 20 families today, this week now, that are desperately in need of a break, of some kind of help and support, and they're not getting any support at the moment.
So, but they're considering actually cutting the existing number of beds. But although there are so many families out there who aren't actually getting any respite care.
Yeah, there are certainly families out there that tonight, this week, would really, really hugely benefit going to use the facility that's there now. So the council is saying if we close down half the beds, we could then save £250,000 and we could put that back in the system to help other families. And I'm saying that we need all of the help and support. The need is great. And even when you look at the 20 families, maybe that's just the tip of the iceberg of families out there that haven't yet been identified.
Okay, but their argument will be, well, hang on a minute, it makes more sense for us to give you the money as a family to deal with this rather than to deal with it ourselves.
I think that's certainly true, and David Cameron wrote an article in the Independent newspaper on the 9th of May, and he said backing respite care means backing the voluntary sector, and he's wanting to give parents more flexibility and more choice, but that could also be interpreted as it's cheaper. And those things are good, and there is definitely room for flexibility and choice and the voluntary sector, but I'm saying we need all of the help and support we could get, and if you take away from these families in order to give to other families, you're likely to send some of these families into a tailspin. Because I was at the meeting at the Bush when this news was announced recently, and it was like watching a fox in a hen house. These parents are already stressed out to the maximum, and it only takes two or three families to go off the rails.
Well, it was lucky that for the council that those extra 20 families weren't in there too.
That's right, yes.
So, I can remember back in the 1990s, Virginia Bottomley, I think it was another Conservative administration in Westminster, she was Health Secretary, and she was pushing this idea of care in the community. Now, this sounds a little bit like that, where they're saying, well, actually, the centres of excellence for caring for people, they're going to close, and we're just going to give people, spend some money in looking after people in their own flats, in their own homes, with their own families, this kind of thing. That really didn't work. So, what are your thoughts about whether this might or not?
For some families, this is going to work, and that's brilliant. But what I'm saying is, for the families that are already totally dependent on this centre, why are you taking it away from them in order to spread around to other families? And if you bear in mind that the money that would be given is called direct payments, which is a non-means-tested benefit. So the question is, why is there no money in the pot at the moment to give those 20 families even today? Because in theory, we're saying, well, if we close down the five beds, then maybe these families could this whole process will not be available, in the money won't be available till next year, in theory. So the 20 families we know of, well, the council knows of, are going to have to wait a whole year. Well, why?
And it's also interesting, isn't it, that David Cameron has his own disabled son, Ivan. You would think that, you know, he would be listening a little bit more closely to the things that you're saying.
I think perhaps part of the salt in the wound at the moment is, you know, I fully respect that people can vote for whatever political party they want to vote for, and that's brilliant. I'm all in favour of democracy. However, if parents are getting leaflets through the door that are telling them £55 million is going to Europe every day, and the local council is saying, look, we have no money in the pot to help you, these are families that are stressed to the maximum. And I'm just appealing for compassion, really, that we need to help them and support them. And I really believe that Bristol is a city of faith and mercy and compassion, and we can extend our arms to these families, the ones that are struggling today.
Well, it's not as if we can't afford it. We've got one of the richest organisations in the country, known as the Merchant Venturers, who absolutely got billions of pounds in their pot, which actually the mayor used to be one of their members until he became mayor and he resigned from the Merchant Venturers. I mean, they are absolutely loaded. So it's not as if the city is poor. Also, of course, many rich people have been lobbying for less taxes on the rich. So it's not as if there isn't the money in the country. We've gone from 7th to 6th richest country in the world over the last year. It's not as if the money's not there. But what other sort of facilities and help does it provide to have a centre? Because I would imagine it's a good chance as well for you to meet other parents who are in a similar sort of situation and network with them, just kind of share your experiences.
I think it's the overwhelming feeling of freedom that you can take a child to a location, you know that they're safe, it's well tested, it's well proven, it's a safe place, and you can drive away in the car and know that they're well looked after and you're not worrying all night as to what, you know, some of these children, if they are still having seizures at night, you are so tuned in to them, you want to know that they're well looked after, and that's paramount. Well, this place is proven to work. It's already up and running, it's working, the staff are dedicated, they're doing a great job. So why would you cut back on that?
Well, I know there's also vacant land next door, isn't there, to the centre. That's the sort of thing that obviously, you know, housing developers, people like that, will be eyeing up. I mean, do you think this is maybe the thin end of the wedge and that possibly the centre is going to be closed, even though it's just been refurbished eventually?
Well, I think there's a possibility in that because the council is saying that this is not primarily a money issue. Well, then what other reason could there be? But if you go to the centre and you look across the fence, there's this big plot of vacant land. It used to be the site of New Fosway School, but it has only one narrow access route onto the site. So you could argue that if you were to demolish the bush completely, then you could build houses on the plot. So maybe this is a phased closure, and I'm only speculating because I don't know the real reason, but maybe this is a phased closure, and in the long-term plan the mayor has got in mind is to demolish the place and make way for housing.
Obviously, you know, it's quite a difficult job looking after a 14-year-old disabled son. I mean, do you find that some families just simply can't cope?
That's certainly a possibility, and I think all of these children, the families would say these children are well loved, just like David Cameron would say about his own son. You know, they're absolutely loved and treasured and valued, but having them in the family does put big pressure on the rest of the family and on other siblings, and when you've got grandparents and other things happening in the family. There are times in life when crises do happen, you know, the storms of life come to every family, and there are times when this facility is really valuable and precious, and I just can't understand why it's being reduced or shut down.
Okay, now just remind us again about this consultation, and also you've got a petition, haven't you?
Well, we've put there's a number of petitions that are up and running on Facebook, and I think, well, the more petitions the better, but we have put a petition on the Bristol City Council website. You could also go onto the Bristol City Council site and bring up the draft commissioning plan and have a look at it for yourself. But if you went onto Bristol City Council /e-petitions, then please sign your support. Please let the mayor know that this facility is really important and we need to be working together to provide for all of the families and not taking away from some families at one end to give to families at the other end.
Well, the petition itself is called the mayor not to reduce, I mean, that's what who's being petitioned and why, the mayor not to reduce the number of beds at the Bush Residential Centre for Disabled Children. And that's part of the e-petitions website at Bristol City Council. That is epetitions.bristol.gov.uk. Finally, Annie, could you just give us an idea of, you know, the sort of things you're worried about? I mean, if this centre does eventually close, or if you lose your son's bed there, the ability for him to go there, how's it going to affect you?
I think the situation that we're in at the moment with our wider family is a temporary one. But my real compassion in the moment was for the other families that are in tremendous need. So it was not really about me and not about my family, but saying, hey, there are families right across Bristol that really need this facility, so please don't close it down.
Well, I mean, it does make you wonder why we're paying our council tax sometimes, doesn't it? When you're thinking to yourself, well, everything almost seems to be being cut and closed. You're paying your council tax, there's all sorts of other taxes we're paying. Also a general sort of reduction in the power of our councillors as individuals when we vote for them. A lot more stuff being privatised. So Annie Walker, from the Bush Respite Centre in Hengrove campaign to stop the closure of the beds, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined by Elia Pablo. Now, hi, Elia, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, thank you.
We're going to have our little tech chat with no Ed this week. We hope you'll be back in a few weeks' time. But there's questions this week about government communications headquarters in Cheltenham. GCHQ used to be Bletchley Park. It was providing some amazing intelligence during World War II, but it seems to have gone a little bit over to the dark side more recently, spying on us as if we're the enemy rather than some sort of a foreign power. But then there's been some challenges to the possibility that maybe GCHQ people may have to appear in court. Some may even go to jail. We're hearing in The Guardian this week that the spy malware operation of the GCHQ is facing a legal challenge. Privacy International is claiming the development of programs that remotely hijack computer cameras and microphones is illegal, as you might expect. So why has it taken so long for this to happen, and what's happening, Elia?
What I would say is, like, these laws existed before the internet, so they were made without thinking that there was some sort of network that could connect absolutely everything. Like, say, they were thinking about telephone surveillance, but right now our telephones are like small computers that can gather data about our location, about our activities, our contacts, absolutely everything. So that's what is struggling, because there is no recording of what can they do and can they not do in the internet. That's the problem.
Ah, what's happened really is the world has moved on from the old laws. But I mean, there still are laws about hacking, aren't they? I mean, you're not allowed. I mean, for example, your smartphone is its little computer. If someone's getting into there, messing around with it, whether it's GCHQ or not, it's still hacking.
I would say if I am a hacker, I would be in trouble. But if I work for the government, they are going to make sure what I'm doing is legal. That's it may be a bit suspecting, but that's how I feel.
No, well, I think you're probably right. I mean, there's also a lot of evidence in the past that when the British surveillance services want to put somebody British under surveillance and they don't want to bother with all the trouble of going to court and doing it legally, that they just pick up the phone and have a chat to their friends in America. And they say to the American friends, can you spy on this person for us, please? And then they go ahead and do it. And they've got a mutual arrangement. So the same with the United States. If the US are going to have any legal problems spying on a US citizen, they will phone up Cheltenham and they'll say, GCHQ, can you spy on this person for us? And so what they're trying to do is keep out of the legal world. The last thing in the world they want is to find themselves in court, and they're quite good at it over the years. But why is it, do you think, that the law has not kept up with the technology?
Well, I would say the law is not interested in that, because the law responds with the government. The government are using this information from the NSA and the GCHQ, and what is more worrying is that the NSA says in UK the law is more permissive than in US, so they actually get benefit of this gap from the GCHQ to get more information through this intelligence service than they would get from the American. So I would say when the governments want to change, when the government see there is a danger and people make the government change it, then there is going to be a real worry about creating new laws.
So the GCHQ is so much part of the government that it doesn't want any laws that might come back to it.
Exactly.
The submission, legal submission by Privacy International details a host of what they call malware, that is software devised to take over or damage computers, with such names as Warrior Pride, Gumfish, Dreamy Smurf, Foggy Bottom, and Captivated Audience. So, I mean, in a way, these programs that they're using are sort of almost taking the mickey out of the public, aren't they?
Yeah, I would like to speak about Tempora. That's like the big malware, and it's actually the one that they said it's illegal. The main one, basically. And it's totally created by the GCHQ. The NSA doesn't have anything to do with it.
So hang on. If I've got an antivirus, surely I can click my little mouse on my antivirus and it will find it.
It doesn't. It's made so you don't... the antivirus doesn't detect it. You will receive it... If it's a mobile phone, you will receive it through a message, text message, saying, oh, this application needs an actualization, and it's going to be an application, let's say, like Windows, that in the laptops, obviously. And then, like, you will receive it through text message, through email, or also they will pretend that they are a Facebook server, and then they will corrupt your computer. And...
Well, the other thing they can do, of course, is just by clicking on a link to a website. I mean, particularly when you click on a shortened link. I mean, a lot of these shortened links are just something like www.t.co. By clicking on one of those, you've got actually no idea where you're going to be sent. So you could go to a web page that then downloads the malware straight onto your phone or onto your laptop.
Yes. And it's like there is no way to know if your computer have been corrupted, if you've been... surveillance, that's the scary thing. And I guess people, like high profile people, they have these hackers on their own, which control their own devices. But people like you and me, we are completely unprotected.
Well, GCHQ apparently had reservations about the legality of these surveillance operations themselves, Privacy International claims, pointing to a leaked document noting that continued GCHQ involvement may be in jeopardy due to British legal and policy restrictions. So they are themselves saying that they're biting their nails a bit. We better keep this very, very quiet because we could be breaking the law.
Yeah, that's the thing. There is no existing law about the internet. It's what I said at the beginning. So we need to create this new law, thinking about all the potential possibilities to internet, which they are infinity. So we don't actually know how many things can they actually do. And then... once they have this law, they won't have any excuse to break it, because right now they can say, oh, we didn't know that was breaking the law.
But what about wartime? We're told that we're fighting this thing called the war on terror, and that Britain is at war with some of these Islamic militants in different parts of the world. So they may just justify it and say, well, we did it because we need to put British people under surveillance because we're at war.
That's what I say. Like, they will when they work for the government, they will always find an excuse to explain their activities, and the government will always be with them because it's in its interest.
World War III as well, a possibility. I mean, apparently the policies of the Obama government, according to some journalists, are saying that this could be leading us towards World War III. Well, we've certainly seen a ramping up with pressure. We're not. There was nearly a war last summer in Syria. There's a terrible situation now in Libya, largely created by the West, where you've got lots of different armed factions still not recognising the so-called new government after Colonel Gaddafi was killed. Now we've got this conflict going in Ukraine. So what do you think about that? Is that really a possibility that the Cold War could get hot quite quickly?
It's definitely a possibility. I see now like a second Cold War, and it's quite dangerous because we have so many incidents all around the world, and in places that there is some kind of interest, like gas or petrol, that's where they are going.
But this is one of the things in Nigeria with all this talk about Boko Haram, for example. Nigeria is incredibly rich in oil.
Yes, yeah. So it's like, what a coincidence that precisely now this is happening. It just feels very, very good for them. Like, it's like these mass destroying weapons that that George Bush said that it was in Iran. So,
and Tony Blair said it too, didn't he?
Exactly. And Aznar, our president by that time. So
okay, so also the Green Party, it's fair to say, has launched a legal challenge of its own over GCHQ surveillance. This is in The Guardian. Rob Evans was writing on the 4th of May. He says that Caroline Lucas, the Green MP for Brighton Pavilion, she is actually part of this new legal challenge. They're saying the GCHQ is violating a long-established rule that bans intelligence agencies from eavesdropping on MPs and peers. They say their communications are likely to have been intercepted by GCHQ, which gathers and stores data on millions of people on a blanket basis. The claim by Caroline Lucas, the MP for Brighton Pavilion, and Lady Jones of Malscombe, the Green Party's two representatives in Parliament, adds to a growing number of legal challenges over the large-scale harvesting of emails, phone calls, and other internet traffic by GCHQ. But I suppose the question I put to you, Elia, is this going to make any difference?
I think it's a start. They are inside the politician wall. So I would say at the moment they feel they are being surveilled, then they start acting. So it's time that it's the first political party that start complaining about this. There is going to be more. They are actually asking for a radical reform, and they want like the election of the membership of the Intelligence and Security Committee, including its chairman. So that's like a first step to control what is the GCHQ doing. Like, because my question is, who is controlling the GCHQ? Is it the government? Is it really the government? Or is them controlling the government?
Good question. Okay, Elia Pablo, thanks very much for joining us. And see you next week.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, I'm joined now by Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi, Jason. Welcome to Dialect again.
Hello, Tony.
We're going to have a look this week at some pretty crazy and interesting, weird stuff. Just around the corner, I know you're from Maidenhead, aren't you? Just around the corner.
I am indeed.
There's a place called High Wycombe.
Indeed.
And it's got a bit of history, hasn't it?
Well, I don't know what you're referring to there.
Well, it's a leading question because, yes, it certainly has got some history.
Would you have to be referring to the Hellfire Club in West Wycombe by any chance?
I might be, yeah. The Hellfire Club was a club that existed around the late 1700s. Of course, anybody that says that such a thing could exist today, I'm sure, is talking complete nonsense. But anyway, it had senior government officials, MPs, poets, this kind of thing, as well as bankers, people like that, are part of this club. And secretly, they would go under the hill at West Wycombe, where there were a whole load of caves dug. And Sir Francis Dashwood, whose land it was the leader of the club. He liked to call himself the leader of the Knights of St. Francis of Wycombe. The Hellfire Club was what everyone else called it once it was discovered. And there were various other names for it too. It was also called the Order of the Friars of St. Francis of Wycombe. Also the Monks of Medmenham. It was all around that area. But the point of joining the club was to have illicit sex with prostitutes. And all these senior government officials were doing this at the time. The weird and ironic thing about the leader of the club, Sir Francis Dashwood, was that he became Chancellor of the Exchequer in the 1700s, but he made a total mess of the economy. And so he was booted out, and then he was made Postmaster General, which means what? It means he can go through everybody's mail. So there were quite a bunch of unsavoury characters secretly getting up to all these sort of various debauched acts. But Jason, what are your thoughts about the idea of people in high society being parts of clubs like this? And, you know, actually, all this happening, although it was centuries ago, just around the corner from you.
Yes. Well, the other side of the river, in fact. Well, I suppose it's nothing new. This is what people in high society have done for centuries. I mean,
well, there was also accusations, very clear accusations, including photographic evidence of this high-class prostitute sitting next to George Osborne,
George
which
Osborne,
was printed
yeah.
in the paper. She was saying that some of the items on the table were to do with cocaine. That was made very much obvious at the time, although it seems to have completely disappeared out of the news.
Well, the
now.
Bowl of white powder, you mean?
Yes, that's right. And also the association with the Bullingdon Club, at Oxford. I think a lot of people are aware that this Bullingdon Club was where many people like Boris Johnson, David Cameron. Also, interestingly, David Dimbleby, the chairman of the BBC's Question Time,
really?
Was also a member of the Bullingdon Club. Because Boris Johnson pointed to him live on a debate where Will Self was on. I think it was around about 2012, maybe a little bit earlier. Pointed to David Dimbleby and said, Dimbleby, he's Bullingdon. So that's the only reason we know that David Dimbleby was part of this club too. Also,
I bet Dimbleby wanted to slaughter him
I
afterwards.
I bet he did. You should have seen his face. Let's move swiftly on and not talk about that anymore, eh? And also Jonathan Ford, who's one of the leader writers for the Financial Times. He was also one of the other people who's been outed as part of the Bullingdon Club. So one wonders if it's a million miles away. But anyway, look, let's go now to speak to the present Earl of that area. I think it's the Earl of Wickham or something like that, who's the inheritor of the land, the inheritor of the title that Sir Francis Dashwood once held. And let's go down the caves and hear from the present Earl.
My sole reason for making the road is the welfare of the villagers. I am determined that they shall have employment.
Chalk for the road was dug out of the caves. About 100 men were employed at a shilling a day. Several years later, the caves were said to have been used for meetings of a very strange club, the Hellfire Club. Its regular meeting place was at Medmenham Abbey on the Thames, about 8 miles away. The real name of the club was the Brotherhood of St. Francis of Wickham, but they weren't at all saintly, although the membership did include a Chancellor of the Exchequer, a First Lord of the Admiralty, several members of Parliament, and other prominent men. Ladies were also admitted. They wore masks and a badge with the words Love and Friendship.
A badge with the words love and friendship. How strange these people were. They were obviously doing everything they could to try and make out that they were perfectly nice, normal. At the beginning of that clip, we heard him talking about making a road. Any idea what that's about?
Well, I suppose they needed a way to get there.
Well, that's true. But also, they also needed an excuse for digging all of this rubble out from underneath the mountain. And so he was saying there, that the reason that he was making a road out of all this rubble was to provide employment for all his employees and people living in the local area, and that he was doing it as a magnanimous gesture. Actually, it was just so he could dig out his caves to have his secret debauchery in them. This whole idea of secrecy, Jason, doesn't sit very well with MPs and democracy, does it?
Well, no, but unfortunately it's been very much part of the system until this very day, and that's the part we should get rid of.
Okay, well, that sounds like a good idea. The Knights Templar at the Dark Side, you wanted to talk about that as well today.
Yeah, it was
because Bristol, of course, is a Templar port. You know, for many years, the Knights Templar sailed their ships from here, etc.
Well,
those ships with the white, big white flag with a red Maltese cross on. Sorry, I keep interrupting you.
Yeah, it was I was reading an article called The Dark History of the Knights Templar, and it was going into the behaviour of the Templars during the Crusades, during the First Crusades, and about how a lot of them are actually, rather than being viewed as these noble guardians, as they claimed to be, they actually slaughtered a lot of their captives. I mean, they just killed anyone in sight who wasn't a Templar.
Well, they're an amazing crowd, weren't they? Quite a frightening bunch. But they, I suppose, thought they could get away with it because people here in England who were supposedly supporting these crusades would never get to hear about it.
Yeah, well, indeed, they didn't. I mean, It's got to the point where, according to the article I've read, they said that it got to the point where the street's so washed with blood that it came up to their ankles and the horses were playing in it.
Oh, no, how disgusting. But, you know, this must have been the idea of Christianity here. You know, it's not surprising that many people in the Middle East decided that they would become Muslims and weren't interested in Christianity. If you've got this example, people riding across.
Right. I mean, it goes on to say the whole point of the Knights Templar, they actually said that they're opposed to what they called the restriction of the Tiara of Rome. Basically, they're opposed to some of the more moralistic restrictions that the Pope imposed on them when he agreed to them. And they were just there to exploit people and make lots of money, effectively.
Well, they did, and they were the very first ever multinational corporation, because they had a multinational bank that spread right across the Western European Western world.
Yeah. There's also a point that there's a wonderful program on National Geographic, I think it was recently, where they actually spoke to a modern-day Knight Templar, and they said, is the treasure here in England? Is it still around? And to which he replied, well, I couldn't possibly tell you that.
Right, so still the secret societies are thriving, along with the Freemasons. All right, yep. Thank you very much, Jason. Nice to see you again.
Been a pleasure, Tony. Thank you. Bristol Community FM, 93.2.
Your voice, your choice. And we hear this week about the dreadful sacking of David Lowe, Swingers and Singers presenter on BBC Regional Southwest. I think he's based in Exeter, BBC Devon, for playing a song which was barely audible using the N-word. Everybody, really, I think, right across the country seems to have weighed in here and saying, what the hell do the BBC think they're doing, sacking someone like this? And also, on his last show, you could tell in the tone of his voice that he was being bullied by the BBC. So we're just waiting, we hope, for him to be put back on the air. Amazing to hear the Prime Minister and Boris Johnson both weighing in on David's behalf, saying what the BBC think they're doing. Boris Johnson condemned the BBC as utterly disgraceful following the sacking of David Lowe for accidentally playing a song which included the N-word. It was also, I must stress, you could hardly hear this word, almost impossible to hear it. And also, it was a obscure version of that song, which used it where most of the versions of The Sun Has Got His Hat On don't use it. He's 68 years old, and he's actually quite an ill man, and he's obviously been made quite a lot worse by the treatment he's been receiving from the human resources and managers at the BBC, who I think maybe themselves should fall on their swords and resign. But anyway, let's hear a clip now from his final show for now, anyway, and let's wish David Lowe a very, very speedy recovery.
Yes, Al Jolson, unmistakably from the soundtrack of the 1947 Columbia film, The Jolson Story. The melody, in fact, was already in existence when Al Jolson and Saul Chaplin collaborated on that beautiful song, the anniversary song. Our final request on tonight's programme is another email. It comes from Valerie Hodges in Cheltenham. And Valerie wrote to say, hello, David. Sometime would you please be able to play Chopin's Nocturne E-flat, Opus 9, Number 2, to Love Again? This is the theme tune to the Edith Duchin story played by Carmen Cavallaro. This was the first film that my husband and I saw when we first went out together, and my daughter had it played at her wedding 20 years ago. It means a great deal to us, and it would be lovely if you could play it. Thank you, David, from Val Hodges in Cheltenham. Val, thank you for your email, my dear, and thanks for asking for this. It's evoked some very, very powerful memories for me as well, because my mum, I don't know whether I've ever mentioned this, I arrived home from school, primary school, back in the mid-1950s, one afternoon, to find my mum standing at the kitchen sink, crying her eyes out. And I said, what's wrong, Mum? And she said, oh, I've been to the cinema, I've seen this most wonderful film called The Edith Duchin Story. Well, within days, she'd bought the LP, and she played it incessantly. So this brings back very powerful memories for me as well. Thanks for asking for it. Yes, Carmen Cavallaro at the piano. And the, well, it was called To Love Again. It was written by Stoloff and George and adapted from Chopin's E-flat Nocturne from the soundtrack of the 1956 Columbia film, The Eddie Duchin Story. The main theme, it was, in fact, it's repeated at the end of the old LP as the finale as well, in a slightly different arrangement. But hopefully the main theme, the opening theme, was the one that you were hoping for, Val. If you'd like to hear the finale or any other tracks from that LP, by all means, drop me a line, because I'll be delighted to feature them. It's, as I say, it's a memorable film. It evokes some pretty powerful memories for me as well. That was our final request on tonight's programme, and if you'd like a request or a dedication in a future edition of Swingers and Singers, it would be here. Nice to hear from you, or hear tonight from you, and you can reach me by post or email or other electronic methods I'll mention in a moment or two. My postal address, as always, for your requests, your letters, postcards and sealed down envelopes, David Lowe, BBC Local Radio, P.O. Box 1034, Exeter. David Lowe, BBC Local Radio, P.O. Box 1034, Exeter. And for your email requests and other messages, it's david.lowe@bbc.co.uk. david.lowe@bbc.co.uk. Don't forget, my surname is spelt with an E, L-O-W-E. Now, you can also make contact with me via Facebook and Twitter. And to save you hunting around for my pages on the same, drop me a line to that email address given to you a few moments ago. Let me know that you'd like to follow me on Facebook or Twitter or both. And I will, as soon as I possibly can afterwards, might take a few days, but I'll get back to you with links to the Facebook page or the Twitter page accordingly, or both of them if that's what you would like. Now, you can also keep up to date with the programme on the blog I launched last May, and you'll need access to the internet, but if you type in mid-20th century music talk and hit return in your browser, that should take you to the blog fairly promptly. Mid-20th century music talk, all lowercase, all one word, 20th spelled 20th. Type that into your browser, hit return. That should take you to the blog fairly promptly, where you'll find reviews of all the programmes up to date, plus a preview of the upcoming programme, which I normally post up on a Friday or by a Friday afternoon for the following Sunday's programme. And that preview, of course, becomes a review on the Monday morning following its transmission, and it sits there permanently, as indeed have all the other running orders and programme details over the past 11 months. Look forward to your company, your visits to the blog, and in addition to the reviews and preview, there are a number of articles submitted by listeners, one or two by yours truly, one or two reviews, CD release or two, and also a little profile about what I'm getting up to behind the scenes in addition to my BBC work. And so we look forward to your visits to the blog in the coming weeks and months. And once again, the address is mid-20th century music talk, all one word, all lowercase, 20th spelt 20th. Finally, if you'd like to hear this programme all over again, you can do so by going to the BBC iPlayer. Once again, you'll need access to the internet. If you go to www.bbc.co.uk/Devon and click on the little BBC Devon icon in the top right-hand corner of the page you land on, you'll see it in a little orange-coloured rectangle towards the top right-hand corner. Click on that icon. That will take you to a new page where you'll see a little link saying Listen Again. Click on that, and that will take you to another page where you'll, if you look on the page, you'll see a little icon saying Schedule. Click on that. That'll take you to a page where there's a calendar at the top. And click on today's date on the calendar, 4th of May. Wait for the schedule below the calendar to change to today's schedule. Then scroll down near the bottom. You'll see my name, David Lowe. Click on that, and that'll take you straight to the iPlayer program. Look forward to your company on the iPlayer in the coming days and weeks. In the meantime, tonight's main theme and the birthday anniversary tribute to one of the great lyric writers, Lorenz Hart, who was born in New York on the 2nd of May, 1895, 119 years ago, just a couple of days back.
That was David Lowe, and an extract there from his last show for now, on after which he was sacked by BBC managers and human resources personnel people for spurious reasons. And thankfully, loads of people right across the southwest, including the Prime Minister and Boris Johnson, the Mayor of London, have all weighed in on his behalf. And you can hear very clearly in David's voice there how he was affected by the bullying. The actions of the managers at the BBC and the human resources, the personnel people, actually seems to work, doesn't it, in the interests of Rupert Murdoch and Sky News. Anyway, time now for the What's On Guide. What are your thoughts about this? Have you got any, Jeff, about David Lowe and his sacking?
I just think it's absolutely disgusting and absolutely terrible. I mean, I enjoyed listening to that show. You know, I mean, yeah, the whole incident has just been dealt with in totally the wrong way.
Okay, what's on this week?
All right, thank you. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 16th of May, The Convicts will be performing with support from the Larry Fish Experiment and also Hell, Death, Fury at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Into Saturday, 17th of May, Blackfire will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. Entry is free and the gig starts at 9:30. Into Song of the Week, and I present Aerosmith. This group formed in 1970, and during their career they have released 15 studio albums, 5 live albums, and numerous singles. This is from the album Honkin' on Bobo, which was released in 2004, and is the song Roadrunner.
Ladies and gentlemen! Let's have a road running wedding, and we gotta get it.
was Aerosmith with Roadrunner from the album Honkin' on Bobo. For more information on the band, check out www.aerosmith.com. Keeping with 17th of May, the John Spencer Blues Explosion will be performing with support from Miraculous Mule at the Thekla in the Grove, Bristol. Tickets are £19.50 in advance and doors open at 6:30 p.m. Finally, on Monday, 19th of May, Courtney Love will be performing at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £24 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. Quite a contrast there between David Lowe and Aerosmith. And that's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast and is on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails and do all sorts of other things via our website. That's dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, Annie Walker from the Bush Respite Centre in Hengrove. Also to Elia Pablo, Jason Yannakopoulos, and you just heard there, Jeff Sparks. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or online at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a good week again. Thanks for listening. Until the same time next week, goodbye for now.
Oh, isn't that wonderful? I've turned that up so loud I've nearly blown my stupid head off. Hold on a second. That's Aulus Mobile from the LP Stop Arrete from Jimmy's Productions. Indeed, it's the title track from it.